This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Why Siri trails Alexa. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
In the battle of voice-activated personal digital assistants, Amazon owns the space over Apple. We'll explain why.
If you don't like being called middle-aged, even if you are, there are a couple of new nicknames being suggested.
How the White House influenced the new national anthem policy from the National Football League.
And do you have the nerve to go to the movies by yourself? Some say it's a liberating experience.
When you start talking to people about this, you do find a pretty distinct split between folks who think nothing of it and, you know, are happy to go spend a couple hours in the dark by themselves in a theater, and others, you know, having grown up with family outings and dates and associating with it as a social activity, feel pretty awkward when they find themselves sitting there in theater alone.
Wall Street Journal entertainment reporter John Jurgensen on going solo at the movies. He's here in about 20 minutes. Well, President Trump didn't mince words last fall when he explained to Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones that he would not relent in his criticism of NFL players who were kneeling during the national anthem. Mr. Jones was deposed in a grievance filed against the NFL by former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick, who contends the league and its teams have blackballed him over his anthem protests. Wall Street Journal reporter Andrew Beaton looked at the notes from that deposition. Andrew, what'd you find?
So we were able to review depositions from Colin Kaepernick's grievance against the NFL, where he has alleged that the NFL and 32 teams colluded to keep him out of the league. But what we found most interesting in there was the testimony from the owners, where they talked about how their conversations with Trump and the influence he had on them. You had Cowboys owners saying that Trump told them in a phone call, "This is a winning issue for me. This, you can't win this one." And then you have other owners, such as Dolphin Stephen Ross, talking about how that conversation was brought up at an owner's meeting. And Stephen Ross, the owner of the Dolphins, said, you know, this really changed the paradigm for us. And that the fact that once this issue ultimately became so politically charged, it really became in some ways a losing issue for the NFL. And that really changed the narrative of what was going on.
Mm. You know, you can argue a lot of things. There are perhaps a lot of debatable points about this, whether or not you liked the president's involvement, whether or not you liked how the players behaved, or whether you support the players, the owners, whatever. But you can't deny that that Mr. Trump is winning on this issue. How did it change, I guess, the paradigm, as the one owner said?
Well, look back to the beginning of last season. The anthem protests had begun in 2016. They were a huge, huge deal. But if you think back to the beginning of the last season, there were still a handful of players kneeling, but it was not an issue anymore. It had sort of faded away, petered into the background, and it wasn't the controversy that it had been in 2016. Then Trump makes his speech in Alabama towards the end of December, where he used crude language, he really attacked the players, it really offended them, and then they knelt as a large group on the games the following weekend. There were more players kneeling than ever before. Owners knelt alongside their players in what amounted to a direct rebuke of President Trump and what he had said. And that moment, beginning with the speech, following with the next Sunday, really turned the issue into a political lightning rod like the NFL had never seen on any issue before. And once it became a question of patriotism in a way that hadn't really become so vivid before, that really changed the narrative in terms of you had the president rallying a large group of supporters to say the NFL is unpatriotic and they're not standing for the flag. It changed the conversation in a really, really dynamic way.
Yeah. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Andrew Beaton. All right, so bring us to now as we begin OTAs and things like that, and we've got the new anthem rule.
Yeah, so it's going to be really fascinating to see what begins next season, because we have, on the one hand, and this idea that, okay, there's a new rule that says players have to stand for the anthem, or they can stay in the tunnel, but they can't go out there and kneel, or their teams could face repercussions. On the one hand, they do this to put the issue to bed and say, we don't want the kneeling thing to be a thing anymore. But on the other hand, we know the players are upset about it. Many of them have said so. The NFL Players Union said they were really upset that they weren't, that this rule change was done unilaterally without their consultation. So while theoretically this was done to put the issue to rest by the NFL, we know that this controversy isn't fading away, because there's still a lot of unhappy campers. They're just sort of on the other side of the issue now. And so we don't know how the players will react come the first preseason games or week one, but I think it's pretty safe to say that this issue is going to fade gently into that good night.
We learn anything, by the way, about if there were collusion efforts against Mr. Kaepernick?
I'm not a lawyer here. I'm not going to speculate one way or the other, but it's a fascinating case, just because we've seen Colin Kaepernick play. We know he's probably better than some of the backup quarterbacks, or maybe even starting quarterbacks in this league, but we don't know the exact reason for sure on why he has gun signed. Was it collusion? Was it just that individual teams chose on their own accord not to sign him? Does it have to do with President Trump? There's a lot of unanswered questions that the arbitration process and the grievance will have to settle.
Thanks, Andrew. Wall Street Journal reporter Andrew Beaton. 12 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Hey, thanks for joining us. Here we are in 2018, a golden age of rebranding. But who's working to reintroduce the phrase middle-aged to the American people? Most folks in the age category don't like that label. Funny story about what middle-agers should be called by Beth Titel, reporter at the Boston Globe. Beth, what have you found?
It's an insult to call someone middle-aged, even if they are middle-aged. So the age group is basically 40 to 65, but to acknowledge that to somebody who's middle-aged feels like a huge insult to people.
And why?
Well, that's what's kind of funny about it. I think that it just comes across as middle-aged is like you're no longer youthful and you're not old enough to be venerated. You're just blah, nothing. I think actually the concept of middle-aged, which is actually only about 150 years old, it wasn't always with us. Before then, there was just four categories. You were a child, you were youth, you were an adult, or you're old. But now then we, about 150 years ago, added middle-aged, and then in 1965, somebody came up with the concept of midlife crisis, and I think that's when it really got doomed, because it was always now been linked with being upset about your age,
right?
Midlife crisis.
Right.
So I talked to people who were trying to come up with alternatives for this. So I think my favorite was a 52-year-old woman in Maryland who came up with the concept of, she called it mid-century modern. She'd been doing a lot of furniture shopping recently and noticed that was very popular. That was great. And then there's a radio host locally who came up with said, listen, let's just do away with it middle-aged completely and just drop to two categories. You're either young or you're old.
Oh, okay.
Which I like, but it's like, where's that line going to be drawn? It's kind of
right.
Scary.
There's no average.
I mean?
It's sort of like there's a median, but no average. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting, yeah, because I think middle-aged sometimes, I think close to retirement, but that is just not the case these days, especially even if at 50, really, most people are not that close.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, actually, it's interesting. So 20 years ago, what used to be the American Association of Retired Persons basically disappeared the word retired, and they now are just officially the AARP for that reason, because people aren't, you know, at 50, people are just getting started.
Yeah. Or, as you reference in your story, for some folks, it's a second act, right? Maybe you've launched a new career or opened a small business after, punching a clock 9 to 5 for 20 years.
Oh, right. It can actually be a really, that's interesting. You're right. It can actually be a really freeing period for people, time of life, because they've made it in their career or they haven't, but now they're saying, well, really, you know, I'm heading toward, you know, older age, what do I actually want to do? What's going to make me happy? So I think for a lot of people, the life stage doesn't have to be that bad. I was really interested in the term middle age.
Yeah.
So that's what really kind of got me. Somebody was saying it could be called perennials, was something someone came up with. A woman I interviewed who lives in France said that in France, they don't even call someone, there's not even a term middle age. But maybe it's just a matter of branding. Like so many, you know, companies and things have rebranded themselves. Like, as we said, AARP, Dunkin' Donuts is experimenting with losing the donuts. Some vegans are now, quote, plant-based, which is considered more sort of benign for many people. meditation, which had kind of an ashram association, has now gone to mindfulness. So you could say the Middle Age just has to rebrand itself. And here in New England, of course, our quarterback, Tom Brady, is 40.
Ooh.
So we're thinking maybe he should have some kind of endorsement deal with Middle
Age,
because who wouldn't want to be like Tom Brady?
That's right. We're speaking with Beth.
Sorry for your non-Patriots fans there.
You're talking to a Jets fan here, but even
even
I can relate. We're speaking with Beth Tytel, Boston Globe reporter. She's written a piece entitled "The New Insult: Calling Someone Middle-Aged, Even and If It's Accurate." So what about the labels themselves? Like, I don't know, we seem to be a country that needs to have labels. We got Generation X and Z and the millennials and the baby boomers.
Oh, yeah,
boomers,
you're right. We definitely need labels. That's what's kind of interesting. Well, but at this point, calling someone middle-aged is almost the kind of, it remains basically a source of humor. It's almost like it's the only group you can still safely joke about.
Mm.
The satirical newspaper, The Onion, had a great headline. It read, "Middle-aged woman angrily demanding price check on rice pudding was once carefree youth. Onlooker speculate." So I love that. And David Sedaris, the author, was just interviewed on the radio, and he was saying that he's 61, and he should be shilling for middle age, but instead he's a whistleblower. He read a book. I heard this interview, a line from his new book. He said, "Though there's an industry built on telling you otherwise, there are a few real joys to middle age." And he told the host, he said, "This would be a perfect time to rob a bank, because when the police said, 'What did he look like?' they'd say, 'I don't know, he had gray hair.' That's all people say. That's all people see."
That's funny. Very good.
Here's the killer.
Yeah.
That perhaps the saddest thing about middle age is this. It's a group no one wants to be part of until they age out of it, in which case they realize too late that they didn't appreciate what they had.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, you might say that about teenagers, too, I guess, right? Because we always say we don't want to go back to that, or they want to be out of that. I don't know.
Oh, right. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. That's funny, because I think the millennials are the one that they hate the label the most, right? Generation X or Z, I think they're okay. Baby boomers don't seem to complain too much, but millennials don't like that label. So we're going to have to approve of one if us middle-agers are going to subscribe.
Right. That's right. Yeah, the millennials, I think it's because that whole generation has been so, it kind of, that as a group, they've been insulted a lot in the media.
They have.
I think that's the problem.
Yeah.
You know, they're branded a certain way, which isn't true, but that's how they've been described.
Thanks, Beth. Beth Tytel, reporter at the Boston Globe. It is 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, getting over the idea of being ashamed about going to the movies by yourself. Thanks for being with us. As attendance declines and ticketing practices change, one of the longest lingering taboos of cinema culture is dissolving, and that's more movie lovers are hitting the theater alone. When they do, some report an almost liberating experience. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Forget date night and family outings. More of us are going to the movies solo. John Jurgensen of the Wall Street Journal has written an article entitled "Seeing Solo, Solo: Brave Movie Lovers Hit Theaters Alone," and joins us now. John, why have some people been reluctant to go to the movies by themselves in the past?
Well, you really, when you start talking to people about this, you do find a pretty distinct split between folks who think nothing of it and, you know, are happy to go spend a couple hours in the dark by themselves in a theater, and others, I think, especially for the reasons you talked about there, you know, having grown up with family outings and dates and associating with as a social activity, feel pretty awkward when they find themselves sitting there on theater alone, especially, you know, in those moments before the show starts and you're just kind of waiting and sitting by yourself. Some people have a real hang-up about it, and actually a lot of people do, and had the folks I talked to had to kind of get over that before they could start really enjoying movies by themselves.
What about adults who want to see kids movies or cartoons or something like that? Do they feel like they need to go with a kid or they'll be embarrassed?
Yeah, now that's a really good point. I mean, I think a lot of the preference really comes down to what the show is going to be, right? You know, if you're going to see The Incredibles this summer when it comes out on opening weekend, especially during daylight hours at a matinee, chances are you're going to be surrounded by kids and families. And, you know, depending on what kind of person you are, that might make you feel a little awkward or a little self-conscious about being an adult sitting in a big theater full of kids and families. You know, but there's certainly nothing wrong with that. I think the thing that I really found that's really making this happen more is that there's just a lot more obstacles to going to the movies now. Getting people to agree on a film that they all can see together is tougher to do because there's a lot of money involved and people have to set aside time for their busy schedules. The biggest factor here is these subscription deals that are making it cost-effective, even more cost-effective, to go to more movies throughout the month. So, you know, with MoviePass, you pay about $10 a month and you can go see a movie a day for that price. And so, having because I have one of these, I realize, you know, that it's a lot easier to just go by myself than to try and drum up friends who are either have to pay for it or, you know, may not have the time. So you end up, just to get the more value out of this deal, you end up going a lot more by yourself. So I think a lot of people in the story I talked to, that was the reason they were going more often, because they had this really valuable sort of cost-effective way to see films, but the most efficient way to do it was just to do it solo. So whether they had a hang-up about it or not, they got over it and started going a lot, and a lot of them learned to love it.
John, do you think, in addition to the movie pass aspect, that theaters themselves will do some things to attract solo moviegoers?
I think that they're just doing whatever they can to get anybody in those seats, honestly. I mean, there's the deals, a lot of the theater chains have their kind of membership points deals where you, the more you go and the more snacks and stuff you buy, you rack up points. So there's another incentive, too. But, you know, I think they certainly don't make it difficult. They certainly, you know, it's easy to go in there and go on your own. But I think they're just trying to get anybody in there that they can. They welcome all comers, that's for sure.
John, your article talked to a couple of people about their reactions to movies, and I've experienced this myself. If you're with somebody you might want to not cry in front of, or you might want to laugh in front of, when you're by yourself, you don't worry about that stuff as much.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was pretty interesting, too, and I guess it makes sense. This one woman I spoke to said that, you know, she ends up going to a lot of these sort of tearjerker movies, but if she was with friends or family, she might try and, you know, keep a stiff upper lip, but maybe not completely break down on the sad parts.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter John Juergensen, 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for four straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in advanced manufacturing, cybersecurity, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan as the most improved state for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Thanks for spending time with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, why Alexa dominates Siri. The wardrobe angst when college president changed schools. Fun story. And the firefighter who created a new coffee with charity in mind. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, if you're like many Americans who are moving to new homes, you do it during the summer, mostly to avoid disrupting the kids during the school year. While most movers are reputable companies that do good work, there are rogue movers operating throughout the country who take advantage of unsuspecting consumers. Here's how from Raymond Martinez, administrator of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. Ray, what kind of moving fraud is there?
How are you, Gordon? Thanks for having me on. It runs the gamut. Very often the type of problems we see are damage and delay of the shipment, overcharges that you were not expecting, and the worst case scenarios, which are the ones that we see often, are hostage loads. This is actually predatory. They're the predatory movers, and they are deliberately scamming people.
Wow. And how does this all unfold, I guess? What's going on? They put the stuff in the truck as if they're going to move it, and then they call you 3 days later and say, we're not returning it unless?
Right. Or, you know, you're going to get it, but it's going to cost you a whole lot more than you originally thought it was. The first thing we tell people, especially if you're going to do an interstate move, which is what we're involved with, we're a federal agency, and if you're interstate movers are supposed to register, are required to register with us. So I would check with our website, which is protectyourmove.gov, and if your moving company that's going to do the interstate move is not registered, it's not on that list, that's a telltale sign right away that you shouldn't be dealing with them. You should be dealing with one of the companies that are on that list. And you can also see whether there's been complaints against the companies on that list. But you also, you know, this is a buyer beware situation, Gordon, because they, once they have your goods, they really have you over the barrel.
Yeah. Jeez. This is mostly an interstate problem?
Yes. And I think that that's where these predatory movers really focus, because they know that They're going to be gone for a while. It's not, you know, moving you over to the next town in the same day. It's an interstate move, and you've got all your worldly possessions in there. And it's really some sad stories. Last year, we had 4,000 moving fraud complaints, and we know that that is underreported because very often these consumers have already gone to their state attorney general's office, their state consumer protection bureaus, their local DA's offices, and they just can't, they don't know who to turn to. And very often these predatory folks, they're ghosts by the time we get to them. So here are some tips that I would suggest. First of all, is check that website, protectyourmove.gov, if you're going to do an interstate move. Look for some red flags. You know, if they're not listed in our database, that's a red flag. If they don't agree to actually do an on-site inspection of the goods that they're going to move, a reputable company would do that because they want to know exactly, you know, the goods that they're supposed to be moving. If they demand cash or a large deposit before they do the move, that's a telltale sign. If they ask you to sign a blank or an incomplete document, if they don't have a local address, you know, that's important because that's a place that you can go and complain to or serve legal papers if you need to, or we could go knock on their door if need be. If they don't have a local address, that's a problem. If they answer the phone when you're dealing with them and they just say movers when they pick up the phone instead of identifying themselves, and very often if they show up in a rental truck, I would ask a question if they show up in a rental truck and not in a company moving truck.
Yeah, very good. We're speaking with Ray Martinez, administrator of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. They've got a new awareness campaign called Protect Your Move, and it's how to keep an eye out for maybe some of these rogue movers who move folks interstate if they're changing homes over the summer. Hey, you were the New Jersey Motor Vehicle Commissioner, correct?
That's correct.
How did you and I crossed paths. Oh, we didn't cross paths. We missed each other by a couple of years when I was there. But how did you survive that job, Ray?
Well, it's an interesting job. I was commissioner of motor vehicles in both New York and New Jersey.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, New York also. Yeah,
and that was good training for this job, which is a national job regulating commercial motor vehicles, and including this area, which is moving companies. And unfortunately, states like New York and New Jersey are both in our top 10 list.
Wow.
Of problem states for this.
Man, that's unbelievable. Very good. Hey, thanks for sharing a few minutes. Nice talking to you. Ray Martinez, administrator of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. Again, the campaign is called Protect Your Move. It is 20 minutes in front of the hour on this weekend. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. Here's an update on Apple versus Amazon artificial intelligence. Siri's general knowledge repository often lags behind Google's and Amazon's. Not only does Siri often not know big things, such as the time a nationally televised awards show starts, but it also trails at trivia. For instance, the age of Wall Street Journal personal technology writer Joanna Stern, as she attempted. Apple addresses this somewhat in iOS 12 by expanding Siri's knowledge about celebrities, food, and motorsports. But tech analyst Rob Enderle says Siri remains far behind the Echo featuring Alexa. He's principal and founder of the tech advisory firm The Enderle Group. Rob, what's happened in this space?
I think what happened was Apple looked at Siri like it was a minor feature. It wasn't really all that important. They promoted it a lot when it showed up in the iPhone and then seemed to forget about it until the HomePod showed up. And then suddenly everybody pointed out the fact that Siri was substantially behind Google, Amazon, and even Microsoft, which is kind of a shame because otherwise the HomePod's actually a very nice speaker, probably the best speaker in the segment, but as a digital assistant, it truly sucks. So that I think a lot of folks were expecting at the Apple Worldwide Developer Conference that Apple was going to step up and advance Siri. You know, Amazon's Alexa gets updates almost on a monthly basis, and Siri not so much. So it's falling farther and farther behind.
What does Amazon do well?
Well, they're just very focused on the platform. They when they first brought it to market, it was very good, and then they've been doing a great job of connecting a product to other things, third-party lights, third-party locks, HVAC systems, the security systems, the rest. It's right now the Echo is the most connected of all the digital assistants, and largely because Amazon has just pounded on this platform. They've recognized it is a kind of a doorway into Amazon shopping in the home, and so it's incredibly valuable to them. And if they can make it so we all depend upon our Echoes, the end result is they're pretty much locked in as our favorite retailer as a result. And so it's very clear why they view this thing as strategic, and they're putting so much effort into it.
Mm. So the race for this, is it just the two of them at this point?
No. Google, you know, strangely enough, Google arguably has the best of them. If you can get over the OK Google part,
really,
it tends to outperform the other three. And Cortana's not bad either. Just nobody uses it. So there you are. But Google actually has the strongest AI of the three of them. It just seems kind of. I don't like it. I'd much rather use Siri or Alexa than I would OK Google to get to talk to something. And I'm assuming at some point we'll be able to pick whatever name we want to use because. It is kind of funny when you're watching an Echo ad to watch every single Echo I've got in the house and suddenly light up and try to respond to what's on the screen.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. It's 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. College administrators often express their school spirit with colorful choices, right? Representing their institution with ties, scarves, dresses, and jewelry. Even shoes and belts when meeting with students or appearing at public events. But as Wall Street Journal higher education reporter Melissa Korn found out, leaving for another school or even for retirement can be a shock to the closet. Melissa, explain.
College presidents move around. That's part of the nature of any higher ed administrator. And I've heard some really wacky stories over the years from presidents about what they do with their wardrobes, because they are expected to show school spirit, including in their clothing choices. So I'll often meet with presidents who are wearing a tie with the school colors or a pocket square or even socks or shoes, jewelry, dresses, you name it, they have it in their school color. So that's great when you're all rah-rah University X, but then when you move over and become president of University Y, you cannot wear those clothes anymore. So I had some presidents talk about handing out their old goodies. So the now president of GW was provost at University of Miami for many years, and he had accumulated more than 50 ties in the
wow.
lovely orange and green colors. And I had one president who held a tag sale because she was perfectly happy to part with her purple clothing after she left as president of Kenyon College. And then there are others who do keep their old clothes just quietly. They sit in the back of the closet, or they wear them behind closed doors.
Wow. This is going to sound sexist, but I'm a husband and a father of a daughter. Is this tougher for women sometimes to unload these clothes?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
I have not met anybody who is quite so wedded to his school color as the president of Northwestern, Morty Shapiro. And the story features a photo that he took of his closet. And he has scores and scores of purple ties, shirts, blazers, shoes, socks, belts. He says he wears purple 24/7, including as pajamas. So that is kind of all in. And if he were to change schools, that would be quite a daunting task to revamp that wardrobe.
Wow.
So women, you know, you can wear a dress, you can wear some jewelry. Men generally ties.
Yeah.
It depends how all in you want to go. And there's certainly some men who, you know, have that bright orange blazer.
Well, we're speaking with Wall Street Journal higher education reporter Melissa Korn. She's written a story about school leaders changing wardrobes when they move on to a new college or university. How about, you mentioned a couple actually who change schools but sort of maintain similar colors. How did that work?
That was convenience. Lucky them. So Morty Shapiro, who I just mentioned, he used to be at Williams, which is also the color purple. There are some presidents who have been able to carry over orange to a few schools.
Wow.
Purple is a very popular common color among schools. Then you've got some of the ones that the shades are similar but not quite identical, and depends how liberal you want to be in your interpretation of those colors, like whether University of Michigan's maize yellow is close enough to gold.
Thanks, Melissa. Wall Street Journal higher education reporter Melissa Korn. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. This guy named Luke Schneider knows our nation's firefighters can use all the support they can get, and he's hoping his growing coffee company can help out in more ways than one. Mr. Schneider, a firefighter and paramedic for the city of Rockford, Illinois, launched a company called Fire Department Coffee less than 2 years ago, in part because he's a coffee lover like so many of his colleagues, but also because he saw an opportunity to give back. A portion of the sales from every order is donated to charities benefiting the fire department, first responders, or military members. He told Fox News that a different charity is chosen about every other month. One charity near and dear to his heart, the AFFI Warrior Program, is a volunteer-only nonprofit that raises money to provide special vehicles to wounded veterans who wouldn't be able to get around otherwise. Mr. Schneider is also in the process of starting the Fire Department Coffee Foundation in order to help out injured firefighters and first responders. He has partnered with a fellow firefighter who broke his back in the line of duty on that project. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.